Hello, I'm Mike Harrison. I'm sure some of you will be familiar with my YouTube channel where I take stuff apart and find out why it's a really bad idea to take things like fuel cells to pieces. Today what I'm going to be talking about is actually my day job, which is designing custom electronics generally for large-scale lighting installations of various sorts, typically involving ludicrous numbers of LEDs, often in insane time scales. But this one I thought was interesting because there's some construction techniques I came up with which might be of interest to smaller scale projects and be usable for other applications. So basically I've been talking to some designers that I've worked with over the years, and they sort of pitch various ideas for retail and for various other sort of architectural type things. And for a long time we've been talking about, let's try and make something just using printed circuit boards. So we've got structure and electrical connection in one place. It also means we don't have to deal with mechanical manufacturers, which can be a real pain. Sort of try and do everything in one. So this was the first idea we came up with, which was basically sort of L-shaped PCBs to make like this sort of cube form. And we got sort of partway through figuring out how this was going to work sort of mechanically, but this project didn't happen. It was pitched and they decided they didn't have any budget for it. So that was a couple of years ago. So more recently, one of these people I work with has moved to Hong Kong, and they started pitching around some of the big shopping malls, and they got succeeded with a pitch to a very high-end shopping centre in Hong Kong called Pacific Place. This is all, you know, designer brands everywhere, and this was quite a big space that needed filling with stuff for Christmas lights, but not tacky, horrible Chinese Christmas lights. Stuff that looked interesting. So we thought, well, what are the themes, you know, Christmas themes, Hong Kong, where the weather's sort of like this but more humid? Well, snowflakes, obviously. I mean, it would be. So we think, well, okay, we got the idea we're going to make something that looks vaguely like a snowflake. So how do we actually, yeah, obviously it's too big to make in one piece, so how do we join all these pieces together? We like the idea of doing something modular, where we could stick things together in different shapes to make different forms. This is the first idea we had. These are a connector made by a company called AVX. If you're ever after interesting ways of connecting boards together, AVX do lots of really cool connectors, particularly for like the LED lighting industry. This is our first idea. So these are basically back-to-back edge connectors. So you can just plug two PCBs in. And the attractive thing about that is it didn't require any connector on the PCB. It was just PCB with the edge that plugs straight in. So in principle, it reduces the cost of your board because you don't have to fit a connector to the board. So we sort of started working out some ideas on this. But this didn't really work out because although you got this sort of nice electrical connection, we needed to add these additional plates just to get the mechanical stiffness. And because of the size of these connectors, it was all starting to get a bit too big. Just didn't really quite work out. Purely just the space we needed, but also the fact that we were making these triangles and actually trying to, because these are inserted from the end, trying to do that on a triangle would mean it would actually be quite difficult to put together. We'd have to start putting chamfers on the end, and it was all a bit messy. So had a long think, and this was really what we wanted to end up with, something where we just snap these things together. So this is what we ends up using. Trying to remember which order things are in here. So we've got these PCBs that snap in using, these are plastic snap rivets, which are super cheap, super quick to install. Now, what you can't do is just mount two PCBs flat to flat because you need something to actively push to maintain the electrical connection. If you just do sort of two bits of flat PCB, the slightest movement means they're going to disconnect. You get creepage over time, and it's generally a really bad idea. I mean, if we'd had time to put a lot of engineering time into this, maybe we could have made that work. But this was really, we had like a fairly limited amount of time, so we had to go with a solution we just knew would work without risk. So I started looking at various options for spring contacts. There's quite a lot of nice little surface mount spring contacts like this, which I started looking at. This is one of these things where having a paper catalogue is a lot nicer than just searching for stuff on the website, because you quite often find stuff that's on the next page that's related, but you never find that just on a web search. So what we end up using is these. These are mobile phone SIM connectors. So we've got six contacts in a nice ready-made package that we can just mount in one operation onto the PCB as part of a normal surface mount flow soldering process. There's quite a few varieties of these. We settled on one particular one by Molex because the thickness was just right. So we have our LED strip, we have our star, and we then have a spacer, which is also made of PCB. And the thickness of this connector just matched up nicely with a 1.6 millimeter PCB as a spacer. So these are actually really cheap. They're 13p. You'll notice on here the quantity showed is zero. Basically, we cleared out the entire worldwide distributor stock of these things, 28,000 of them. And again, because we were on a fairly tight timescale, we had to make sure we had the stock before we committed to the design. So we just had to go and just buy enough straight away before we pushed the button on anything else. So for a while, it was quite hard to get hold of these because we had them all. So these are the sort of the final components of the system. We've got this LED strip, which is a two-sided assembly. We've got a total of six RGBW LEDs on there. Now, the RGBW bit is quite important. Incidentally, there's a small section over there. Afterwards, you can come up and take a close look at that. But you'll see that actually looks, it's quite a nice sort of pastely colours. Because obviously our theme was snow and snowflakes, so we wanted quite a lot of white in there. And RGB by its own makes a horrible white. It just looks horrific because of the color variations and the color balancing. It just looks totally nasty. So by adding that white in there, it means you've got most of your light, which is white, is coming out as a fairly pure white. And then you can just use the RGB to tint and accent it. The other advantage is white is a ton more power efficient. So compared to generating bad white with RGB, compared to standard white LED, it's something the order of 8 times more efficient in terms of the light you get out versus the power you put in. So that's another big advantage. So these are the components. We've got the one on your bottom right, that's the star interconnect. So that provides the mechanical interconnect and also the electrical interconnect via these pads that touch the SIM card connectors on the strips. So on the strip, we've got these six RGB LEDs, RGBW LEDs. They're all wired in series, so we've got a 24-volt supply, and we're just using current-limiting resistors, so we don't need to mess about too much with constant current power supplies. That's then driven by a PIC. I'll go into a little bit more detail there. That's a PIC 12F322 from memory, I believe, which is a nice low-cost device, and I'll go into the details in a sec as to why that was a really almost ideal device for this project. Sorry, I lie, it's 12F1501. Incidentally, in this presentation, there is one mistake. If anyone can shout out when they see that mistake, I'll give them a free one of my prototyping boards. So just shout mistake. It's a little bit further on, but it is a very obvious mistake to anyone that knows what they're talking. I just spotted it when I was reading through it a minute ago. So there's some more details. Obviously, that gives us our star plate. We've got these strips. We can snap them together in almost any hexagonal arrangement we like. Then we've got the drop attachment, the things these are actually hung from. So we got this thick PCB. It needed to be a little bit thicker than standard PCB just to get the rigidity. So at the bottom, you can see the actual shape. I did quite a lot of iterations. I got one of these little cheap CNC engravers that was really handy for cutting out these test pieces. So that basically just snaps into a slot in the centerpiece. And we've got this right angle pin header that just plugs into the socket on the black part you can see on the right. So as long as you're careful and line the pins up so they don't bend, these snap together really easily, because of course, once this vertical is in, it's a rather unwieldy thing to carry. So we've got these things manufactured flat. They're all assembled flat and packed. And then when we came on site, we snapped these vertical pieces on. Then the other detail on the left is how the hanging cable connects. So we've got this sort of hook on the end, so the cable loops through it twice. That gives us our mechanical strain relief, and then it plugs in. There's a little notch there so we could actually put a cable tie around there, which is actually fairly unnecessary, but it reassured the client a little bit that it wasn't going to fall down. You'll notice there's a couple of holes on that bottom piece. There's a couple of holes. The idea is that we'd snap it in, then we could put a wire through it as an extra safety precaution. Again, that's something that we told the client, they're a bit worried. If you actually try, it's almost impossible to pull one of these apart. They're very, very strong. We actually forgot to put those wires in and nobody noticed, and it hasn't fallen down, so I'm not too concerned about that. The only other thing we needed, because these were flat and obviously PCB is a bit flexible, we actually had put some suspension wires. So what we did, we had a couple of holes in the vertical, and then we had some custom wire forms made out of, I think it was something like 0.5 millimeter stainless steel wire, which had hooks preformed in the end. So again, something we did on site was we put the things out flat, we plugged the vertical in, we then threaded these wires through, and that then kept the whole thing flat, so you suspend it and it holds itself nice and flat. And you can see on the right, you can see how that hook, it's like a V-shaped hook, so you just push it through and it snaps through, so it's really quick to assemble. You go snap, snap, and it all holds together. And these have been pre-made on a machine that gets the length precisely right, so all the obviously the length of that wire is critical to get it totally flat, so that had to be got just right. The other thing we did, obviously we've got an array of these snowflake shapes. Now, if you just hang them, they're going to sort of twist and rotate relative to each other. And of course, we wanted to do nice patterns sweeping across it and like coordinated shapes across the whole thing. So we needed to stop them rotating. So we had these additional pieces, which again, use the same snapping detail. And at the other end of this strip, it just passes through a slot. There's no fixing. It just passes through it. So that basically ties pairs together so they can't rotate relative to each other. So as long as each pair is linked, then they're all going to stay the same way around. And again, that was a quite neat solution. Again, yeah, all entirely made out of PCB, no extra parts. I don't think we actually, there were no, the only thing that wasn't a PCB was those mechanical wires. Everything else is done, yeah, standard electronic PCB process, which is something that I'm familiar with, and I don't like dealing with subcontractors in areas that I'm not familiar with because it gets too stressful. we tend to speak different languages. So back to the pick that we used. I don't know how sort of technical you are. Please go to sleep if this is boring, but I won't stay on this too long. It was a really nice fit for this project. It's got four PWM channels, which means for RGBW, that's perfect. All the dimming is basically done completely in hardware. It's 10-bit. Now, that's important. You might think, well, for doing dimming, all you need is 8 bits. That's actually not true. If you just want to do a nice fade from like completely off to completely on, if you use 8 bits, what you'll find is the bottom few, at the dim end, it'll get really steppy because the eye's response to light is nonlinear. So what you generally do, if you want a nice smooth fade, literally all the way from black up to however bright it goes, you need a minimum of about 10 bits, and you then apply a curve, which is the opposite of the eye's response. In practice, a very good approximation to that is you simply take the 8-bit value, square it, and then use the top however many bits your hardware supports, and that works really nicely. And of course, computationally, it's really simple. These picks have only got, I think, 512 words of memory, so even a lookup table would have been difficult to do, but all it's doing is it's taking the 8-bit value, multiplying it by itself, and slapping it out to the PWM hardware. Some other nice features, it's got self-programmable flash, which means that we can upload the firmware over the cable. So this entire installation, if we needed to, we could upload the firmware in every single pick. There's 60 picks, segments per snowflake. The total was about, I think, 14,000 strips in the entire installation. So obviously it's really important that if we needed to, we could update the firmware easily. Also, it can hold a device ID. It hasn't actually got E2 PROM, but you can self-program the flash to achieve the same thing, and I'll go into that in a second. It's got an internal oscillator that's accurate enough to do serial communication, so that's one less component we need to deal with. It's a 5-volt part. It'll run from anything from, I think, 2.5 up to 5 volts, so we don't need a precision voltage regulator. We just have a resistor and a Zener diode to go from our 24-volt supply to our pick. Yes? Yes. See me afterwards for the prototype board. Well done. Right. So, yes, it's cheap, 50 cents, and one really, really nice thing I like about PICs is that Microchip will supply them ready programmed with your code for very, very little money, far, far cheaper than using a third-party programming service. So for another 6 cents, our chips already had all our code in it. In fact, because we could upload the firmware, it actually, the thing that you really need is to have a bootloader, because there were some changes I made to the firmware after we'd send off the order for the picks. But because they had the bootloader in there already, the jig you'll see in a moment, part of the programming process, we also uploaded new firmware to it. But the fact that we didn't have to stick these on an in-circuit programming jig across like 14,000 boards was a real-time saver, and also because the assembly was being done by a subcontractor in Hong Kong, it's one less thing for them to screw up. You say, here's the chip, it's got the code in, stick it on the board and it works. And the other thing is it's got some built-in test facility so that when you turn it on, it'll cycle through all the colors of the LED. So again, for the subcontractor to be able to test it, all they had to do was power it up. And again, there's a slide further on about that. Quick detail, it doesn't have a UART, so we're doing 125K board serial, which is quite fast, but we can actually do a soft UART if we cut a few corners. Instead of the traditional approach of doing a soft UART is you basically have an interrupt on the start bit, and then you generate an interrupt on each bit that you want to sample. Now, once you get up to higher baud rates, that becomes a bit problematic because of the amount of time it takes to get you into and out of the interrupt routine. So what I do, we still generate an interrupt on the start bit, but we stay inside the interrupt code for the entire duration of the byte, which means we can sample at, I mean, I've used this up to about half a megabit, and it works fine. We used an additional stop bit just to give us a bit of extra time to deal with getting in and out of the interrupt routine. So I originally did this using DMX, which is actually a 250K board with two stop bits, and that extra stop bit really is a lifesaver. The disadvantage of this is that your foreground processing doesn't, if you've got this data streaming in continuously, every byte you get in takes up almost all of the processing time. That's a vaguely representative picture at the bottom. But fortunately, because we've got this hardware PWM, the only thing the foreground task is doing is waiting until a new packet comes in, saying, yes, I've got the packet, here's my RGBW bytes, squaring it, throwing it out to the PWM hardware. So, and it's got a complete frame time of about 30 milliseconds to do that. So even if on every incoming byte you only get like three or four instructions executed, that's fine, that still works, which is great, and it's cheap. So this is just some of the detail of the this interconnect star. So it's a two-layer PCB. We've got plus 24 volts ground and data. And say it's data, it's 125K TTL level UART data, which works fine over. We had, I think, up to about 10 meters of cabling. We made sure that we didn't produce sort of nasty spikes. We sort of smoothed it off, so we've got nice sort of controlled rise times. And that works beautifully. And it'll work at twice that bit rate, but we just didn't need that. So we decided let's play safe and keep everything going as slow as possible to minimize the things that can go wrong. Now, within this Starflake shape, we've got 60 strips. Obviously, we need a consistent way of addressing those strips. They're all sharing the same data bus, remember. So we've got each strip sees this stream of data, and it needs to know, well, where am I? You know, which of these bytes in this incoming data do I need to respond to? So each strip has a unique ID programmed into it. And to do this, we made a jig. So our original idea was we'd, as well as programming, we also need something to help with the assembly, because these are going to be assembled by other people in Hong Kong under our supervision. So the idea was we'd get, say, a sheet of MDF, mill out the shape, then you just drop all the strips and stars in. The problem is that, you know, we're here and that's in Hong Kong, and sending out a 4-foot square sheet of MDF to Hong Kong is really not a very good idea. So I came up with this idea of making a modular jig, which again is made out of PCB. So the jig actually follows the same form as the shape that you're trying to create. We've got these strips, we've got the stars, we've got the locating pins, so that what you do is you assemble this jig by again snapping it together with the snap rivets. You drop all the stars onto the jig, you drop all the strips onto the jig, you then push all the snap rivets in, and that then gives you your physical structure of that's the right shape. And also on these jig, we've got these little programming pins, and that's connected to a programming box, which is part of the jig system. So that once you've assembled it all up, you push it down. We use like croc clips and bulldog clips just to hold it down to make sure it's making contact. And the jig would then generate data. And these pins effectively act like a chip select. So remember, every board is seeing exactly the same data, so how do you know how to program that particular one? So we send a command that says, ID number 46, but only if you can see your pin being pulled low. So the jig just pulls each of these pins in turn, sends the ID command, and then each strip within the jig is programmed. We then do a test so we can see it all lighting up, we can see it's all in the right order, we can see everything's or got the right address. And that process takes about sort of 15 seconds, I think, that entire process. These are a few little details of the jig. Unfortunately, I forgot to take some decent quality pictures of these. So you can see the various parts of the jig. You can see the strips here, the stars being ready to drop on. There, that's the complete jig running through its test. So as it goes through its programming thing, the various colors on the LEDs just indicate the progress. When it's finished, it flashes some fixed patterns, which are designed in such a way that, because the eye is very good at recognizing patterns that are or aren't there, the eye can immediately spot in the error, so we can verify that all these have been programmed correctly. So that's the actual process of the Snowflake itself. In terms of the system as a whole, each of these Snowflake, 60 strip Snowflakes, plugged into one of these units. And what this does, this has got a high-speed RS-485 bus running between two or three of them. That then takes data at 2 megabaud, and it then splits that out into 12 simultaneous streams at 125K board for up to 12 Snowflakes. The dark squares you can see on the right are polyfuses to provide protection. So obviously, each Snowflake would take up to about 2 amps at 24 volts at full load. So we've potentially got 24 amps going through this thing. So we have this individual polyfuse protection to avoid sort of, if to say a cable short, to avoid setting anything on fire. Shopping centers really, really hate that. So you want to make sure smoke really gets them gets them twitchy. So there's safety there. There's also some Zeners and resistors, so that if, for example, we had a short between our data line and our 24-volt line, it wouldn't blow anything up. It would just it would just sit there and draw a little bit of current. But so there's some little Zener diodes and some resistors and some, I think we used some PTC polyfuses on the data lines as well. So just to make sure that it was pretty much idiot-proof, you could do anything, it just wouldn't. Yeah, the worst it would do is not work. It wouldn't set, kill anyone or set anything on fire. This was part of the factory test. Like I said, having the firmware in the PIC from the factory meant that we could do some tests. The strips were made in panels of, I think, something like 15 strips on a panel for the whole surface mount process. And we actually put some tracking around the panel so that you could take a complete manufactured panel, plug 24-volt power into it, and then all the strips on the thing would cycle through all the colours. So it meant the manufacturer could instantly check that all the LEDs were working, there weren't any shorts, very quickly and very easily. And again, that's part of the instruction we give to the manufacturer. So hopefully what we get from them is pre-tested, known working strips ready to go on the jig. And also you've got that secondary test procedure once we go through the jig. But it means that any bad soldering or so on, in theory, that should be taken care of by the factory that's manufacturing the strips themselves. Right, that's the actual architecture. I've just got some video of this. Unfortunately, there is some video of the full thing with all the final animations. Unfortunately, no one's got around to editing it yet. So this is a mixture of a build video and also some footage I shot on site with some test animation, because I left Hong Kong before they'd finished doing all the programming stuff. So this is just a sort of general overview thing. I've edited some of the boring stuff out of here, but this is part of the actual process of installing. That's me going around testing every single drop wire before it got lifted, make sure all the cabling's working. So these were put, there was a custom framework made that was put on winches, and then it was winched up, the snowflakes were put on in sort of height order. It was then just gradually winched up and more snowflakes put on, then winched up and more put up, and then pulled up to the final height. So this is the big installation in the main foyer. It's like a Christmas tree type shape. And then around the sides, there were some long, thin installations. It's like a sort of round building with like thin corridors that go all the way around it. So we've got this big feature thing at the front. And then around the sides, we've got these thinner parts, which I think are, here are the side bits. The nice thing, because it's this nice open shape, it's very transparent. It doesn't look like a huge sort of thing. We're filling a lot of volume, but we're not really making it like a big lump in the space, because it's very transparent. You can actually see through it quite nicely. And when the snowflakes are off, you hardly even notice they're there. But obviously when they come on, you see the light, you get some really nice reflections from this curved glass. So you look up, you see the things, you can see the reflection from the glass, the curved glass, which is quite a nice effect. So the overall aesthetic, I mean, the end client was absolutely delighted. We're actually going back in October. We're going to take the strips, we're going to rearrange them into things that look less like snowflakes on different frames, and we're going to put them back up again as a sort of permanent installation. So these are the ones that are down the sides. There are four different clusters, which are just sized and shaped to fit the shape of the space we had to put them in. So you can see this nice reflection on the lift shaft, this curved glass on the lift shaft on the left gives this really nice reflection of this this cluster here. Say that unfortunately I don't have, there were some quite nice animations that were done, but unfortunately I don't have any. I think at the end there's some really grotty video that actually some guy in Hong Kong, I found it on YouTube, someone had been through the shopping centre and actually videoed it, so I've just stolen a few snippets from that video just to show some of the animations, but it's rather poor quality. But saying I need to go and kick someone and get them to actually edit all the footage they've got of the final thing. So that was all shot quite nicely, but just it's been sat on a hard disk for a long time. So these were just me just wandering around waving a camera just to get something. But you get some quite interesting, because they're flat. As the angle changes, you get different sort of impressions of it, from sort of high density to low density and so on. I think this is the footage of the animation. They say this is a rather bad YouTube grab, but you can get some idea of the animation. I think on every hour they played a tune through the PA. Remember, this was Christmas theme, so they played some jolly Christmas tune through the PA system. We had this animation that made them all, do all cool sort of funny animation color things, and then it went back to a more sort of passive sort of gentle background thing in between that. So you can see some, we're sort of generating some shapes with these animations based around that hexagonal shape. But Yeah, I'll leave that playing. So we've got 5 minutes. Any quick questions? Yeah. Oh, someone's going to come to you with a microphone. So I've got this spotlight in my face. It's a bit hard to see.
Hi. Could you tell us something about the software used to generate these animations? Was that you or someone else?
That basically, for almost all these installations, my responsibility generally ends at the USB port. Yeah, yeah. So the most I do is some software just to fire it all up, find the addresses and test it. All the creative stuff I leave to creative people. It's not really my something I have anything to do with. It was running on a Mac Mini. That's about all I know.
Any more questions?
Any more? You have that.
You showed us the boards which have like a megabit coming in and several lower board rates. What was providing those megabit streams to feed all of those?
That was coming out of a quad USB to RS485 interface. That's just got an FTDI, FTE4232H. It's basically, they're made by a subsidiary of FTDI called EasySync. They do these nice industrial boxes, which I use all the time. And RS485 is a really good way of getting a crap load of data out of a PC easily, cheaply, easy to debug. It's a lot easier than Ethernet in a lot of respects.
Thanks. And how long did it take to put up?
Each of the big clusters was one night, and I think the big front one was two nights. We obviously, because it's shopping center, we can only work overnight. So, yeah, we made good progress. We had some contingency, but we did. It was damn hard work, but we did actually. We had a really good installation crew. For example, assembling those suspension wires, we showed these guys how to do it once and they were just on it and they just did it beautifully. It was really good. Yeah, that saved us a ton of time, the fact that we could just show them how to do it and we knew it would get done. It would get done right. Any more?
Yeah,
this one. What was the total power draw of one of those clusters, just approximately?
One limitation we had is the only power we had was a number of 13-amp sockets in the proximity of each section. So some of the design constraints actually came from that. So each snowflake was about 57 watts. So it's 24 volts at two, no, must have been about 2.5 amps. I think the software did actually have like a metering thing, so we could actually measure from the content how much power it was going to draw, and if necessary, we could cap that, because obviously we didn't want to be any fuses to be blowing. But I think in the end, we did actually have a system where we could, if we wanted, run it up all, I think either all at 100% or three out of the four colors at 100%.
How did you do in kind of manufacturing yield and failures in the installation itself over its run?
We didn't have many failures. Obviously, we've got a lot of strips. So if one strip went down, it wouldn't be that noticeable. I think it certainly in terms of dead strips from the factory when we were assembling, there was about half a dozen out of 14,000. Failures during the installation, I don't have the figures, but it wasn't a huge number. It was no more than tens, I don't think.
I think this is possibly last question.
Right. So you've got a lot of LEDs in a fairly small space. Was there any sort of consideration for like the thermals of it?
Basically, because they're all spread out, it just isn't an issue. I mean, for things where I'm generating fairly bright lights, where possible, I would sooner, for example, use a cluster of six small LEDs than one big power LED, because that heat is spread out, so you don't need a metal clad PCB. You can run that flat out. It will get a little bit warm, but no more than that. And also, because we're using white, the white is so efficient, we can get a really decent amount of brightness. I mean, those LEDs are running at, I think, about 15 milliamps. They're not even running at their full power.
Right, okay.
There's one at the back.
Were you waving at the back?
No, he's just fanning himself.
Okay. Can we thank Mike, please?
Yeah. So if you want to have...